as I suggested yesterday, this is part of something that is happening throughout the culture, though I think the church has a vested interest in it. I say throughout the culture because anybody who is interested in health these days has recognized the importance of the connection between body and mind and spirit. And we in the church are in a particularly strategic place to make a difference in this. And that's part of my concern this week, is to heighten your awareness of that. Now, yesterday we talked about whole person health care. I like this particular diagram of it. It comes from Project Life, an effort on the part of the Nebraska Senate of the ELCA to promote practices of health and wholeness. This is an image of God in the middle, which is at the center of whole person health from a Christian perspective. And then they have identified seven dimensions of this. And I think that's a good way to think about it. Occupational, and we know what happens to people right now who are out of a job, what that does to them in terms of their health. Spiritual, physical, emotional, environmental, social, and intellectual. All of those are dimensions, and all of them interrelate with each other. I would substitute interpersonal for social, because that's the dynamic, I think, of connectedness to other people that's particularly critical for health. And I'll talk about that more in a little bit. Now, we ended up last time with beginning to focus on...
Time for my medicine.
Time for your medicine. Okay.
Project got a little higher.
That's perfectly all right. I can't project any higher. I could boost this up maybe with some
hymn books. Should we?
Why don't we get a few hymn books? Maybe we can get it a little higher.
I'll grab a couple books back.
Well, maybe we could just stick it, leave this here, and put it in between there.
That way?
Yeah.
Explain to you got a pretty good foundation.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Well, that's sit on there.
It's
a little rocky. A little bit more this way. How firm the foundation, right. Okay, we're just going to use this for the first part, and then we'll take it down anyway. This is a one way to think about the meaning of spirituality. And as I suggested yesterday, spirituality is a universal human characteristic. Everybody is spiritual. I think of it in terms of being in the image of God. Every person is created in the image of God. And that means that there are human capacities for things like a personal value system and relationships to yourself and to others and having a meaningful purpose in life. That's what distinguishes us from the rest of the created order. That's what it means to be spiritual, I think. So everybody has spiritual needs, and everybody is spiritual. And as Dean was suggesting last night, universally people form religions in order to meet their spiritual needs. And so he was saying in Africa, you didn't have to bring religion over there, but it is religious already. So we're talking about a universal phenomenon when we talk about spirituality and religion as a way of meeting spiritual needs. Suggested that internal and external relationships are a dimension of that. Your relationship within yourself in terms of self-awareness, self-esteem and so forth, relationships to other people, and the kind of connectedness that you have to others. I'll talk more about that in a little bit. The value system, what is at the center of your life? Luther said that that's really what determines what your God is. What's at the center of your life? What do you organize your life around? Faith makes both God and idol, Luther said. Everybody needs a God and needs a value system and needs some central meaning and purpose in life. And that's what constitutes their religion in the deepest sense of that word, of having a purpose in life. Now, that's where we left off. I ask you to think a little bit about roadblocks to spiritual health, and I want to take just a few minutes for some brainstorming on that. What do you think are some roadblocks to spiritual health? Think about yourself and other people.
Anxiety? Any physical disabilities can be.
Any physical disability can be a threat to your spiritual life. It can also be an occasion for growth, as it is for many people. But it's certainly a threat to spiritual life. What else?
Selfishness.
You're turned in on yourself.
Momentary discomforts, whether it's stress or if it's a toothache or, you know, whatever. Anything that just focuses, takes your attention, somebody losing their temper at you, you're coming close to an accident, it really has you so absorbed in yourself for the moment.
Good, yeah, I think that's a good one. It may be helpful if we focus it in terms of what's a roadblock to spiritual health in terms of meaningful purpose in life?
In terms of what?
A meaningful purpose in life. What's a roadblock?
Unemployment,
where your purpose in life is suddenly taken away from you through no choice of your own, and the center somehow is gone for you. That can be a roadblock.
Death of a spouse,
more likely to be in terms of an external relationship, but also can affect your whole sense of purpose in life.
Especially younger.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Low grade or failure or anything like that.
Failure. Failure is a big threat to spiritual health.
If you lose your health.
Right. Losing of health, Roman?
Excessive appetite in all the meanings of the term.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Passions
that can finally subvert and destroy what is at the center of your life. Lots of ways in which that can happen, or having a purpose in life which ultimately does not serve well as a center. If you base your whole sense of purpose in life in being a success and you lose your job, then you really do initiate disorganization. What about personal value system? What are some roadblocks to spiritual health in terms of a value system? Think of anything?
Well, you said that everyone was spiritual and were created in the image of God. So to set priority values less than that, to say that your values are penultimate always
good,
would then lead to your roadblock, would it not?
Yeah, it would, because any penultimate value if always has the potential of being an idol, serving as what you perceive to be God. Well, to pick up on what Carl was doing this morning, too, if your value system is death-dealing because of what you value, then it's obviously a roadblock to spiritual health. And you can have a conflict in values that are good, that can be a roadblock to spiritual health. One of the biggest ones, I think, is the tension between caring for yourself and caring for other people. And we have a lot within the ethic of the church that continually focuses on our care of other people. We get very little help in talking about the kind of care we need to give our own spirit and bodies and so forth. So there can be a conflict between values that that are good. And internal and external relationships, the roadblock there, I think, is estrangement. It's my favorite word for sin. If you are cut off from yourself, you are in a state of estrangement. If you are cut off from others, you are in a state of estrangement. And above all, if you are cut off from God, you are in a condition of estrangement. And all of them cause problems in terms of spiritual health. They're roadblocks to spiritual health. So that as background, Carl, give me a hand and let's get rid of this thing here. Just move it over there so that that's out of the way. So what I want to have us focus our attention on this morning are discerning spiritual needs. And this is important for discerning spiritual needs in other people that you care for and being sensitive to that. But I'm more concerned this morning that we pay attention to our own spiritual needs. And I want to do an exercise with you for a few moments that will help you do that for yourself. But I want to start off by demonstrating the importance of attending to spiritual needs for health, for whole person health. Maybe you read the story in the paper about the 10-year-old boy who got off the school bus in the schoolyard and fell over dead. It was a boy who was very lonely and isolated. His mother had just gotten married, and the stepfather and his mother virtually ignored him at home. And the only people who paid any attention to him at school were people who made fun of him, made him an object of ridicule. And they did an autopsy on him, but they could find nothing that was wrong with him physically. His heart had simply stopped beating. Now, any speculation about what was the cause of a death like that has to be speculative, obviously. You might call it spontaneous dying, in the way that medical people say that when somebody is healed and you can't explain it, you call it a spontaneous healing. But certainly, the helplessness and the hopelessness of that young lad had something to do with his dying in the way that he did. We know some of that, I think, from animal studies. If you take dogs and put them into a situation where they are given a shock, an electric shock, and they cannot escape, eventually they will give up. And they won't even try to escape, even if you give them the opportunity to escape. It's a condition of simply helplessness and hopelessness that sets in. That's even more striking, I think, in experiments they've done with mice. If you take a mouse and put a mouse in a jar of water so that they cannot escape, the mouse will die very quickly from a slowing of respiration and a slowing of the heartbeat. And that will happen even more quickly if you clip their whiskers, which is the way that a mouse orients itself to the surroundings. But if you do the same experiment and place a mouse into a jar of water, but then take it out each time after a brief period of time. Then after a while, the mouse will swim for long periods of time without any indication of giving up or dying. And it's the condition of helplessness and hopelessness that seems to be a key factor in what happens to bring about a premature death. The heart and respiration simply stop. Now that is at least, I think, a plausible explanation for why a 10-year-old boy who was completely isolated would drop dead in the schoolyard. Now, I start with that as a need, a spiritual need, the need for hope, because everybody recognizes that that is an essential for health. We have animal experiments to support it, the ones I've just mentioned, and any physician will tell you that once a person has given up the will to live, who has no more hope, that the best they can do will not be enough. And hope is a spiritual factor, and spirituality is the turf of the church. We can certainly welcome what anybody else has to contribute in terms of sensitizing the need for hope. But who is in a better position to keep hope alive than people who have the message that Christians do, centered especially in the death and the resurrection of Christ? Hope is a spiritual energy that gives people the will to live, rather than being a kind of passive kind of thing. Hope is as essential, I think, to spiritual health as anything that you can talk about that contributes to physical health. And it's a basic spiritual need that is true for all of us. Now I want to mention two other spiritual needs and then ask you to brainstorm a little bit on spiritual needs that you're aware of within yourself and in other people around. A second spiritual need is the need for love. The need to be connected to other people. And ultimately, of course, to be connected to God and the love of God. And we have all kinds of evidence, again, of the difference it makes as far as health is concerned. A recent study demonstrated that people who have a heart attack are 50% more likely to have a second heart attack within 6 months if they are living alone. Isn't that striking? 50% more likely to have a second heart attack within 6 months if they're living alone. That's true for every major disease that we know about. That those who are isolated and do not have adequate social support, the mortality statistics are 2 to 5 times greater for people in that kind of situation. The Alameda study of 7,000 residents in California over a 9-year period is one of the most often quoted health studies because it is a prospective study rather than a retrospective study. A retrospective study is you take a group of people and then you look back over their past history and ask, well, why did they get sick? But the Alameda study took 7,000 residents in Alameda County, which is right across the bay from San Francisco in the Oakland area, and followed them for 9 years in order to see what the morbidity and mortality statistics would be. And what they discovered, this included questions about marriage status, close friends, relatives, number of contacts with others, membership in church and other organizations. And those who were single, widowed, or divorced, or who had few close friends or relatives and did not join or participate in community organizations, died at a rate of 2 to 5 times greater than those with extensive social ties. And that was true irregardless of age, or ethnic group, or religious orientation. In another study of 170 pregnant women, 91% of the complications which occurred during pregnancy occurred in women experiencing stressful life events with low perceived social support. 91%. The rate of complications was 3 times higher in the low support group compared to the women with high levels of perceived support. And the Hammond report, which is the report on which the Surgeon General based his final determination that you had to put on every pack of cigarettes, this is dangerous to your health, that same report said that being divorced, especially in the early stages of that, is equal in terms of the mortality risk to smoking 20 cigarettes per day. In other words, living an isolated life is as great a threat to your health as smoking. You may have read recently about studies that show that the French have less heart disease than we do, and so there's been a lot of plugging of red wine and olive oil as a result. But I wonder, you know, one of the things that characterizes the French, if you know their culture at all, is that they spend long periods of time in eating together. That's a ritual event for them. And what do? We golf down quick, fast food in between two pressing kinds of engagements in our life. And maybe the studies that show that people who imbibe in alcohol have lower heart risk than those who are don't imbibe at all. Maybe part of that is that what the alcohol does is lower the kind of resistance that we have to intimacy, and that people are simply sharing more in terms of connectedness with the aid of the alcohol, maybe happy hour, that's what it is that contributes. It's the social connectedness, I think, that comes through consistently. I'll mention only one other thing as a demonstration of this, as a spiritual need that has health consequences, to the recent study by Dean Ornish, and one of the books in the bookstore is about his study, which has gotten such wide attention. He did a study of the only thing that has been able to reverse the complications of heart disease other than some kind of medication or surgery. And in his study, he took a group of people, they did a number of things on diet and exercise, but what Dean Ornish concludes is it was the social support they gave to each other in their regular meetings that really made the difference. Let me just give you his concluding comment. It's very difficult to motivate people to follow a diet or to stop smoking or to engage in other desirable behaviors if one doesn't also address the underlying issues. Telling somebody who is feeling isolated and unhappy and depressed, and who feels his or her life is out of control, that they may live longer if they just eat less meat or stop smoking is not terribly motivating for many people. Because many people who are unhappy don't want to live longer. Anyone who smokes can just read the Surgeon General's warning and know that it's not a very helpful thing to do. Yet a third of Americans smoke, and in some countries it's 50 to 60% of the population or higher. So providing people with health information is important, but it's not usually sufficient to motivating lasting changes in behavior. If instead we work at the emotional and spiritual dimensions of health and illness, addressing these issues of what brings a person a sense of inner peace, contentment, meaning, value, and intimacy, then that individual is more likely to make choices that are life-enhancing rather than self-destructive. Ornish has it right, I think, in terms of identifying what the real need is. It's a spiritual need. That's what he's saying. And that's coming from a medical researcher who sees the difference that it makes when you pay attention to spiritual needs. And telling his own colleagues that we need to pay attention to this. Certainly we in the church who have been given special responsibility for spiritual care need to pay attention to that. Third need, and then I'll let you brainstorm a little bit on needs, is the one that was on the overhead, the need for purpose, the need for meaning and purpose. Bill has talked about that in terms of people in prison camps. We have all kinds of studies that show that people without a meaningful purpose suffer consequences to their health. We have reports from people like Bruno Bettelheim and Elie Wiesel and Viktor Frankl, who talk about the search for meaning as the key to what people need for a healthy life. Some center to life around which you can organize all the rest of your life. And as Christians, we would say nothing does that in a way that is as complete and total as having that life centered in Christ. Anything else is an idol that may work for a time, but ultimately will crumble because it cannot satisfy when the needs are the greatest. And we'll talk more about that on Friday when we talk about healthy dying, and why we can say that dying itself can be a healing and healthful thing to do. Spiritual needs. And now what I want to do is to open it up and say, what other kinds of spiritual needs are you aware of? I've talked about purpose in life, love and connectedness, and hope. What else would you talk about? Esther, would you maybe start us a list? Hope, meaning and purpose, and love, connectedness. What would you add to that?
Some security.
Security. Some sense that it's okay, some reassurance that it's all right. Oh, wonderful.
And feeling that you're accepted.
Yeah.
In that way.
Acceptance. A need that you are accepted. Be things about you which other people may look at strangely and yet accept you as a person. We talk about that in Christian terms as agape, as an in spite of love, even if there are things which are not lovable.
I was going to say that some people or some organizations or whatever, mental illness is still looked down upon as if it were, you know, back in the dark ages.
Yes.
People didn't understand it. They were thrown in prison or whatever. Just, you know, some people still do not accept it as part of your physical being. It's pretty important, isn't it?
Your thinking. Oh, yes, indeed. It's central.
So that's being cut off or something.
Yeah. People with who develop a terminal illness often talk about the isolation that comes with that, of people not knowing what to say, and mm-hmm. so they get cut off, and what they need is acceptance. What else? Room.
Sense of accomplishment in a meaningful task or occupation.
Good.
I think you say the same thing in an unaccomplishment task or such as vengeance, and that there has been evidences of that keeping a person alive because of the drive to get even or to err. But fortunately, if the individual could live, he has to shed it. But at that time, their drive for vengeance and getting even keeps them alive.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. I hadn't thought of that before.
And
but things, right? The things that we would normally identify as evil,
right,
and want to be rid of, can in fact, for a period of time, be life-sustaining. I think you're right. Over the long run, that vengeance, that need for vengeance, has destructive consequences,
right,
within the self. And you'd want to replace that with what?
Forgiveness.
Yeah, forgiveness.
I was trying to put that down. Evil becomes what?
Necessary?
Life-sustaining for a time, for a short time.
It could be the same with anger and grief.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of pulls you through it when you go through that angry period.
Mm-hmm.
I missed one. When we were talking about acceptance, somebody back there said something which I missed.
Someone says accomplishments.
Before we get away from forgiveness, I just want to highlight the centrality of that need as a basic human need, because estrangement is so much a part of our life, a life in which we live in a world of sin, that we're cut off from ourselves and from others and from God and from nature. And so the need to live out of forgiveness in a world where we're constantly aware of what cuts us off from the sources of life around us and how we participate in that makes the need for forgiveness a very basic spiritual need. Carl?
Just recognition.
Recognition is a good one, I think, in contributing to self-esteem.
Not just who you are, but what you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are all very good. Think of others. One that I would add is a need for control. One of the most frightening things for people who are ill, particularly in an illness that cannot be terminated, is that they've lost all control. And we feel most secure when we have some sense of control or some assurance that things are under control. And so if we get a reassuring word from the physician, I can take care of this. Or ultimately the sense of control that we feel in being in the hands of a loving and caring God meets that spiritual need. But there is a need for some control, some sense of control in life.
New experiences, even if they're small experiences. I mean, just a nurse coming in with something new that brings some response to a patient.
Good.
Or even child, new expensive stuff.
New expensive, maybe the little baby she brings. You know, for people living all alone in the countryside, and a baby comes into that family, that new experience is something.
Yeah, I think that's good. Very basic.
Well, that's why they've found that animals, dogs, and kittens, and birds, and that for the elderly are so beneficial.
Good. Anything else anybody can think of?
Well, sometimes people don't appreciate elder people. I mean, the younger ones, they may or they may not understand.
Understanding, part of it is acceptance, again, of somebody different from you.
Or somebody with a disability that is embarrassing. Yeah.
Now, what I want you to be aware of is that in all of these that we've talked about, there's a penultimate and an ultimate way in which you find that those needs are met, or a means on the horizontal plane. I mean, you get love from your spouse and your children and from others who are friends that sustain that need for love. But there's also an ultimate way in which that is met, and only met in relation to God. And the reason I emphasize that is that all of the ways that your spiritual needs are met on the horizontal way can fail. Your spouse can die. There are other threats that are beyond your control. And ultimately, when you go through the gates of death, you go through by yourself. Nobody goes with you unless you have your hand in Christ and who carries you through those gates of death to the other side. So there are different levels at which these needs are met. And I don't say that to denigrate the ways that they're met on the horizontal plane. They're absolutely essential. But they're never fully sufficient. You can get reassurance from other people about what's going on in your life. But the ultimate reassurance comes in saying the 23rd Psalm, or in the reassurance that St. Paul talks about when he says, neither life nor death nor principalities or powers, nothing can separate me ultimately from the love of God in Christ. So just be aware of in terms of how spiritual needs are met, of the different levels at which those needs are met, and they're important at each level. Now that's background for what I want to do with you now, and that's an exercise for discerning your spiritual needs. And it's also a way to plug my book, by the way. I'm going to be using an exercise from the Healing Presence, which was published by Harper's last May, and of which there are many copies in the bookstore. And I'll autograph it for you. If you
and they are not at the half-price table.
That's right. But they may be if people don't buy them. These are guided imagery exercises for healing and for wellness and for recovery. I've got a whole section on spiritual needs and ways that spiritual needs can be met. And I'm going to be doing the one on discerning spiritual needs. I have used guided imagery a lot in both the area of understanding death and dying and healing and paying attention to spiritual needs. And next week I'm going to devote a whole day to talking about the use of this as an instrument. But I want to say just a few words of background to it if you haven't done guided imagery, so you know what to expect. The imagination, I think, is the most powerful tool we have for accessing resources within ourselves, and we tend, unfortunately, to shut it down very early. Children are just loaded with imagination, but we teach them to think logically and clearly, and of course that's how you succeed in our world, which works in terms of linear and logical modes of thought. But we need ways to put ourselves in touch with our imagination and access what I call deeper levels of intellectual experience, getting beyond the abstract cognition to a deeper than intellectual experience of what is going on in our lives. And guided imagery is a very useful way to do that. I'm going to be playing some background music, and I will put you in a state of relaxation in a darkened room late in the morning that may put you to sleep. But you probably need it. So don't feel badly about that. Just try to keep your snoring as light as possible. I do that because your imagination works best when you are in a relaxed state. And you can then more easily go down into yourself and be in touch with your inner experience. I hope that you'll find it a useful journey. I'll be doing more of this later in the week as a way to help you in your own personal kinds of journey with this. There'll be a couple of periods of silence in which I'll be asking you to use that time for your own internal reflections, and just follow as well as you can the direction that I give you through the course of the exercise. To either close your eyes or keep them focused on one place in the room so that you can pay attention to what is going on inside of you rather than what is happening outside of you. We take too little time for ourselves, our needs, especially our spiritual needs. And what we are feeling and thinking deep within the core of our being. Concentrate on your breathing, breathing in and breathing out, sensing the inner rhythm of your body, yourself, feeling the peace that comes with adjusting your whole being to the rhythm of your breathing. Letting all the problems that you've been wrestling with slip away from your consciousness. Allowing yourself to come to rest. Letting the thoughts that pop into your mind simply float away, like balloons drifting toward the sky. Be aware of how many of your needs are met daily, without much concern on your part. Food to eat and clothing to wear. Fresh air to breathe and clean water to drink. A safe place to live. So many ways that you have been blessed. So many needs that have been met. Feel the goodness of being alive at this very moment. and blessed with so many of the gifts of life. Your thoughts and feelings to your spiritual needs. Reflect on the spiritual needs that you can identify for yourself. Maybe opening your eyes just enough to scan the list on the board if you need to remember. Let that list serve as a grid through which you can filter your experience and identify the spiritual needs that are most prominent in your life right now. As you reflect on each of these needs, like love and purpose in life, identify experiences that have made you conscious of this need. Pass judgment on your spontaneous selection of experiences by asking, "Why did I think of that?" Trust your intuitive grasp of what is deep down important, and simply record in your mind's eye what you're aware of. I'll give you a moment to record the experiences you remember. As you reflect on the spiritual needs that are prominent in your life. Scanning in your mind's eye the list of spiritual needs, select one need that awakens the greatest intensity of feeling in you. And in your mind's eye, enter into that need, letting yourself become that need for a few moments. re-enter one of the experiences when you were particularly aware of that need and feel what you felt then. How would you describe the need from within your experience of it? What exactly is it that you need? And who can supply it? Is it okay to have this need? Or is it hard for you to admit it to yourself, to others, to God? Are you able to ask for what you need? Or do you expect others to observe that need and respond to it without your asking? After you have taken the time to enter deeply into this spiritual need and to experience it from within, reflect on what you are feeling and thinking, beginning with these words: what I need is, and then let the words express themselves within your inner experience. Don't analyze or critique what you are experiencing. Simply give expression to it and reflect on its meaning. From within the inner world of your experience, reflect on the religious dimension of this need. Is it also a need in relation to God, perhaps particularly in relation to God? Do you see your faith as a resource in meeting your spiritual need? Would prayer help? What would you pray for? For God to do something? For the strength and courage to do something yourself? Is there any portion of Scripture that comes to mind as a resource for dealing with this need? Take a moment to reflect on your need within your relationship to God. And then, when you feel ready, give expression to your faith in response to this need. Perhaps in the form of a prayer, or a meditation, or a dialogue with God. Use whatever form of expression seems most natural to you. Thank you. As you feel ready, reorient yourself to this room. Refreshed in mind, body, and spirit. But do that gently. Be kind to your human spirit. If we had more time today, I would take some time to give you an opportunity to share with each other some of what that experience was, and I encourage you to do that with people you feel comfortable talking to, because some of the richness of this can come in the sharing of spiritual needs, particularly with people who can help you meet those needs. And so I'm sorry we ran out of time and we're not able to do that. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the faith factor in healing, which I've been very interested in the last few years, of just how central faith is as a factor wherever healing takes place, and also in terms of preserving and promoting wellness. So that's our topic for tomorrow.